Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, acknowledging the vital work of local public health departments to keep Californians safe during the pandemic. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, Fresno teachers weigh in on the debate over reopening schools in the fall. And a local winner of this year's National Heritage Fellowship tells us how music and culture connect us to our past. But first, throughout the coronavirus pandemic, the state has tried to reduce the risk for people experiencing homelessness by providing funding for hotel rooms. Some have been reluctant to accept help. But as FM89's Laura Satsui reports, a team of physicians and medical students in Tulare County are trying a different approach, using healthcare to connect people to housing.
Vera Miles has lived under the trees along the Tule River in Porterville for 5 years. The 60-year-old shares the space with her partner. She says she's not worried about getting the coronavirus.
I think we're safer down here than anywhere, actually. And with this going on, I'd rather be here.
But living outside is hard. Miles has chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD, and asthma. And in a pandemic, it may feel safer, but it is dangerous, says Dr. Omar Guzman.
There's no access to water. I mean, no one's wearing masks. Even if you wore a mask, if you don't change it, it just becomes a nidus for infection anyway. They can't wipe down their encampments.
He's out here offering health care to people like Miles. Guzman runs Cahuilla Delta Medical Center's street medicine team. He, along with volunteer physicians and medical students, go out every other week to homeless encampments throughout Tulare County. On this day, Guzman tells the team this work is like making house calls.
No one's waiting for it to be seen. There's no line, okay? So spend time and talk to the patient, figure out a little bit about them, you know, really make that patient-doctor connection that you guys were supposed to be doing, right? All right, any questions? No, we're good? All right. So.
And with that advice, 15 people grab intake forms and start walking along the river. Street Medicine's mission is to meet people where they are, providing preventative care. It's been done in Los Angeles and San Francisco, and some studies show it works to reduce the time and money spent treating homeless people in the emergency room. As we walk, doctors and students call out.
Anybody here? Hello? We're with Street Medicine. Is anybody around? Does anybody here need to see a doctor?
Diana Trumbull says Street Medicine was one of the reasons she chose Cahuilla Delta for her residency.
My name is Diana. I'm one of the second year emergency residents at Cahuilla. And then one of the medical students is going to be following me. But no, this is new for me, so it'll be interesting.
After 40 minutes of looking for tents hidden along the riverbank, Trumbull meets Holly Bella, who tells her she needs some antibiotics.
I had a pair of channel locks stuck in my leg.
Oh, no.
The 55-year-old Porterville native points to a scarred spot just above her ankle. She says she went to the hospital when she was injured, but lost the antibiotics after getting treatment.
I tried to keep it real clean, you mean? Keep it clean and stuff. And I did have one of those cast boot things on.
Oh, okay.
But that thing was so damn big.
I know.
It was like just gigantic.
Trumbull pulls an antibiotic from a backpack stocked with medications. An attending physician from Cahuilla Delta signs off on the prescription. It takes 10 minutes.
You're going to do one pill twice a day.
Okay.
For just the 7 days.
Trumbull tells Bella that Cahuilla Delta is testing for COVID-19 further up the river. Bella says she'll check it out and the team moves on.
Yes, thank you very much.
No,
thank you.
Problem.
God bless you guys.
You're
thank
welcome.
You. Yeah.
By the end of the morning, the group reconvenes. Only a few people accepted medical treatment. In larger cities like Visalia or Tulare, sometimes the team talks to 30 or 40 people. Veronica White is a housing navigator with the King's Tulare Homeless Alliance, and she's out on the river today, too. She says many of the people here are reluctant to accept help.
The client that has COPD, she's always been very closed to services. She never really wanted to come out to talk to any of us. And I think it was her husband who convinced her to meet with a doctor, and that opened up the door to be able to talk to her about our Project Room Key and our housing programs.
She's talking about Vera Miles, the woman we heard from earlier, who's lived out here for 5 years. It helps to have the medical team, says White. They can offer immediate care, whereas housing involves paperwork. But sometimes it becomes clear to patients that housing improves their health. Here's Omar Guzman again.
We were able to house two of our patients that were in a big need of housing because they're getting to the point where they're going to be hospitalized. I think they'll probably, if they were to remain out here, would have been hospitalized within the next 48 hours.
Guzman says the team will be back in a month or so. Soon, street medicine will have a weekly outreach to get more people preventative care, and if they're open to it, connect them to housing. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui in Porterville.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. K-12 districts have been grappling with how to educate students in the fall without contributing to the spread of COVID-19. Yesterday, I talked with a group of teachers from Fresno Unified to hear their hopes and concerns for the upcoming semester. Joining the conversation was Roosevelt High School Applied Medical Science teacher Kelly Rausch, along with English teachers Christy Leba from Edison High School and Aaron Gilbert from Sunnyside High School. I also spoke with music teacher Peggy Munoz, who works at 4 elementary schools in Fresno Unified, and started the conversation by reflecting on what it was like when campuses closed.
You know, the day after closures was interesting because usually when we close or when we go on break, there's always this sense of goodbye, like we'll see you again. And so coming, you know, like the Monday after was just, it was difficult because you're like, I don't know when I'm going to see my students again. But coming away, I feel very sad because I know that students are having a difficult time. You know, I think home lives sometimes are challenging, and they look for this kind of outlet. There are some students who really need school. As far as my personal experience, it has been challenging because you look forward to what you do, and I feel that it's my calling to do this and to enrich the lives of students, and not to be able to do that has been difficult, you know.
I can imagine.
I feel like this shelter-in-place situation has created anxiety levels for different individuals, and I think that I thought maybe, no, this can't happen to me, you know, but it has. And I think you have different types of fears. You wonder, if I go somewhere, you know, am I going to, you know, contract COVID-19? And then if that happens, how will that affect my family? And so these are like looming questions all the time. And this is not a normal time. It's just a different way of living, and things are just not normal.
Not at all. Not at all. So I would like to throw the same question to Christy. What have the last several months been like for you?
Well, as a teacher of 12th graders and following the news in February, I anticipated that we were going to have a situation in California. So I planned a little bit ahead, and I got all of my classes started on their next unit at the end of the quarter. And on that last Friday, as I was getting messages from various people around school, and people were sharing things from the news through our teacher email, and it started looking more like we were going to shut down, you know, I just tried to reassure my kids that we will continue as best as we could, and they had everything they needed. They had their novels, they had a reading schedule, they had an ongoing assignment. And the theme for me was, you know, you keep a positive and cheerful face for your kids, and inside you are scared and nervous, but you try not to share that with the kids, and you just try to reassure them that we'll get through it okay. So Friday.
That's got to be a really difficult balancing act. I mean, keeping it together.
That's exactly the hardest part, because even as we moved into K teaching online, it was the exact same thing. You know, you schedule a Zoom meeting or you set up for a video conference with your kids, and you have to figure out how to be the most supportive and cheerful and positive person you could be, even though you're experiencing the same grief and dread and confusions. And to me, that emotional balance of trying to be there for my kids, but also not denying how myself as a person feels, was so extraordinarily difficult and exhausting.
Kelly, you know, there has been so much confusion and mixed messages related to COVID-19. I'm wondering if you can speak to thoughts you're having about what will happen in the fall. As we're talking at the moment, Fresno Unified has not announced what its plans will be. What are your thoughts about it?
So thank you for asking that question. It comes back for me to the science, right? And science is not black and white. Science is very gray. As we move along through this pandemic, we continue to learn things as we go about the characterizations of the virus, the effects that the virus has on different people, et cetera. And that is confusing, and it's also very frustrating for many people because we all want an answer. We want to know when we can go back to school because, and especially us as teachers and parents, right? We want to send the kids back to school because we know that that's the best scenario for them. It's the best scenario for us too. But as we move through this and things continue to change and we continue to learn more, what we're finding is that we can't make any reasonable predictions based on the science. We just don't have enough data. The sample sizes are too small. We went into crisis mode and, you know, entered shelter in place. So kids were taken out of schools. We aren't sure how the virus is going to affect them if we put them all back together and then add the layer of teachers and the interactions, et cetera. So I think that from a science perspective, although my heart and my soul absolutely wants to go back to school, from a science perspective, I don't see how it's possible. I don't see any way to do that safely. And I'm appreciative of the district, you know, of our teachers association, et cetera, that are standing up and saying, you know, we need to look at the safety of our children first, their communities, our communities, and our teachers and all school staff as we move through this process and move into making a decision.
Erin, what are your thoughts?
I'm nervous, and I have made the personal decision to keep my own children home to do distance learning. I have a lot of support here from my family and extended family, so it'll work out for us. And I realize the amount of privilege I have with that because I recognize that most parents are not in that same boat as I am. As an educator, my heart is broken. I taught 12th grade for the first time last year and fell in love, and I want to go back and have that experience all over again, and I can't, and I am heartbroken about it. But it's more important, as Kelly said, to keep our children safe, keep our communities safe. We work in a socioeconomic environment that the kids, you know, sometimes don't have enough to eat. They don't have a place to sleep. I am worried to death for those kids. I understand that it might be better for them to be at school. I would hope, and I am confident that our district will provide for those kids in ways that new ways, because we're going to have to make a new normal. We're not going to be returning to a normal.
Christy, you're a longtime educator. I'm going to ask you a question that's probably impossible to answer. But is distance education working, with an understanding that every student's situation is unique? But in general, I mean, how many students are falling through the cracks?
Well, I think that's almost an impossible question to answer because we just have a difficult time tracking kids. You know, like adults, kids are riding very great waves of emotion and dealing with their immediate situation, and that impacts how well they're able to connect and how well they're able to focus on schoolwork at any given time. And it seems to me that as we're reaching out to our kids and trying to, you know, include them in whole group activities, not everyone's going to be able to make those time periods and those connections.
So, you know, following back with those kids and with some one-on-one outreach and trying to connect with them through email, through chatting applications, through telephone calls, you know, I probably would say I was working just as many hours at home trying to scoop up all of the kids who were not logging in with the rest of the class and doing some one-on-one work with them. And I still wasn't able to connect with each kid every week. And that was heartbreaking because, you know, that's our goal, is to reach every kid every day as much as we can. And for my 12th graders, I feel like they were able to manage themselves a little bit better. And I don't know if they were falling through the cracks so much as making a choice that they had to put their efforts somewhere else. But, you know, it's just like when we're in school in person, you know, you have absentees, you have kids who come to class and are just not in a space where they can learn that day for whatever reason. And you just have to deal with all of those situations on a one-on-one basis and do the best that you can, which I think is what all of us are doing even now.
Of course. Peggy, you're a music teacher. What is the fall going to look like for you in the event that classes are all online?
That's an interesting question. You know, I'm not real clear, but if we did some distance learning during spring, and so it was, you know, I would drop into some of the meetings that teachers had with their students, and then we also provide recordings, which is an easier way to get your lesson out to more students. So, you know, I'm thinking that it'll be different. We're obviously, the learning curve is great. So we're still in the process, you know. I know that we're going to have a lot of development, you know, as far as whatever technology we're going to use and, you know, just approaches to coming into the classroom or providing lessons for the students. But it is challenging.
Absolutely. For all of you. Kelly, I'd like to come back to you. You are, and correct me if I'm wrong, but a third-year teacher at Roosevelt in Applied Medical Sciences?
That is correct.
So given that, and so this was a second career for you, teaching was, I should say. Does that at all complicate your situation?
Wow, that's a great question. So I actually do think about this, right? I spent 20 years in biotechnology in the Bay Area, and that was a successful career for me. And I always knew in my heart that my heart's desire was to teach. And for a number of reasons, I didn't do it at a younger age. But when my husband and I moved to the Central Valley, I was able to envision that and partake of it or participate in the profession. So it's very hard for me because I am older as a second career teacher, and it means everything to me. I have a much smaller window than people that are going into teaching at 25 years old. And I want so badly to have a positive impact on the lives of the kids that I teach and all of the kids in Fresno Unified, as well as leaving some sort, you know, leaving them with some sort of life skills and legacy that I've hopefully helped them to develop over time. Countering that with my need and desire to be more vocal about what my concerns are has been hard. It's hard for me to understand or to wrap my head around the fact that maybe I shouldn't speak up in the light of all of this and I should kind of toe a different type of line. But here's the thing. The thing with me is that the students are always first. Their well-being is always first. Their education is always first for me. And so I put those concerns at bay and I do what I think is right for the students and for the community.
But in this case, there is an element of a rock and a hard place, though, here, right? Between
Correct.
Your concerns over your personal safety and your desire to be there in front of your students.
Certainly. And my situation is one that I'm actually in a high risk category. And so that is difficult for me because it would not be beneficial for me and for my personal health to go back to school. So there is a rock and a hard spot. And I think that is true for you know, as I stated before in my first set of comments, I don't feel that the safety factor is there. So that part of it, that's just my bottom line on it. And for my own personal safety, you know, you have to balance. It's kind of like I keep thinking to myself, put your oxygen mask on first. I have to put my oxygen mask on first. And wherever that leaves me, that's where I'll be.
Erin, do you have any follow-up? You're in a similar situation in that this is a second career for you as well, right?
Absolutely, yes. I am a third-year teacher as well. And so I have found through the 3 years of teaching that there's so much history to our district and to my own personal school. So you kind of have to navigate some unwritten rules that you're not really aware of, but you know, you want to be respectful of the history of the struggles that the teachers before you have gone through. So I've felt like through this quarantine process, I've had to really rely on veteran teachers that I count on as sort of mentors to say, okay, is this normal for me to be scared about? Should I be worried about X, Y, or Z? And I've had a lot of support in that capacity. So truly, I just sort of feel very similar to Kelly. I have at-risk children at home, and my husband is also at risk. So I feel like we just really have to put the science ahead of politics and everything else that comes with the district and the state of California, for that matter. So we need to protect our kids at all costs.
And what is it going to take for you to feel safe to go back?
Personally, for me to feel safe to go back is to be meeting the CDC and OSHA standards that have been set forth for the type of sanitation that would need to take place. And also some sort of diagram for a classroom of our sizes. They vary through the district. So individualized diagrams that show how we can seat kids safely.
And Kelly, given your background in biotech, do you agree?
Absolutely, 100%.
So, Christy, I'd like to give you the last word here. What do you think the public is getting wrong about the situation that teachers are in right now? Or what do you think we misunderstand?
I wouldn't say that the public is getting anything wrong, per se, but what I would like to maybe put back to the center is that teachers and families are partners together in the education of their students, and that teachers are also people just like them who have the full life array that they also have to deal with, as well as trying to be present for their children and the students in their classes. So I would just like to maybe bring the humanity back to the forefront of this. And, you know, as teachers, we care and love for our students. We are heartbroken with them as each week goes by and as we wait for details and information. But at the same time, we're dealing with personal fears and decisions that are equally hard. And whether we are meeting face-to-face or online, I do truly believe that teachers are working their hardest to make the best possible situation for their students, and teaching themselves how to be better at distance learning, working hard to work together with other teachers to provide unified information and consistency across classes and grade levels. and I really just feel that there's a perception that the teachers have been on vacation since March. And in fact, I think we've been really wrapping our brain around how to be better at doing distance learning in the case that we'll have to do it better this time around.
I just want to thank you all for everything that you do. And thank you for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you for giving us your time
and our input.
Yeah.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. And now it's time for our weekly COVID-19 update with FM89 health reporter Carrie Klein. Last week, we talked about Kern Medical's plans for expanding its capacity in the event of a surge. And this week, we hear from two other hospitals with creative solutions of their own. So, Carrie, welcome back.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks.
First, how has the Valley fared over the last week?
So again, not very well. COVID-19 case counts, hospitalization, deaths are rising across the board. In the last week, the seven counties in our coverage area reported 48 deaths and close to 6,000 new cases. And we're now starting to use some of the overflow sites in our region. Both the Kern County Fairgrounds and Porterville Development Center have seen their first patients in the last week or two. And I've been noting a change of tone among county health officials. Both Fresno and Kern offer regular calls with the media and the public, and both of them are expressing very serious concern about hospital capacities, and they are imploring the public to avoid gatherings and to follow social distancing and masking requirements. And some of these counties have banded together and created a valley-wide website. And that is, it's a site to find some basic information about the disease, about symptoms, what to do if you think you have it, and where to find testing. It's pretty helpful. And so the website in English is valleycovidhelp.com. In Spanish, it's ayudadelvallecovid.com. And then the last big thing is that there was a big change in testing strategies statewide. Governor Newsom and his team announced this earlier this week. There's been a tremendous backlog in testing, many people know. And now there's a tiered system for who will be given priority. And that's a priority for testing, but also for processing. And so the people who get the most priority are those who have symptoms or frontline workers like doctors, EMS workers, things like that.
Wow, that is a significant change.
Mm-hmm.
So can you walk me through some of the news from the counties in our area?
Right. So if we go through it briefly, so in Fresno County, county health officials have changed how often they're reporting data to their data dashboard on the county website. So there's just so much data to sort now as case counts rise. And for the sake of accuracy, they're now only updating case counts twice a week instead of every day. Most counties still do report every day, and not everyone reports on weekends, some do. But anyway, that's one big public-facing change if for those who are actually looking at the data dashboards. In Kern County, Kern is no longer on the state watch list, which means that some of the governor's restrictions from earlier this week don't actually apply. So gyms, churches, salons, businesses on that list, they can stay open until the governor restricts those for all counties. In Kings County, last week, the first death was reported at the state prison in Corcoran. So the Corcoran case count had risen sharply in mid-June, not as high as some other prisons like Avenal, but the case count had gotten under control, but you know, tougher cases do remain. And so there have been four deaths at Avenal and one at Corcoran. In Madera County, cases continue to rise sharply, though no records were set in the last week. And in Merced, county health officials are working on some prevention campaigns that target Spanish-speaking communities, and that involves distributing information, hand sanitizer, and masks at some places like flea markets and in migrant farm worker communities. In Tulare County, they are slowly needing to close county offices after employees test positive. This week, it was the Porterville and Lindsay district offices, and in the past, it's been Tulare Works offices in a number of communities that have had to close. And in Mariposa, the best news in our area is always in Mariposa. The case counts are rising there, but very, very slowly, and still only one person has died this entire time.
I love how you always end with the best news.
Yes, yes.
Which unfortunately, there's not a lot of this week. So last week, we talked about strategies hospitals are using to increase their capacity. Kern Medical, for example, is planning to hire traveling nurses and get permits for more beds. What have you heard from other hospitals in the last week?
Well, so one big new arrival this week is teams of military healthcare workers. As far as I know, this came on very quickly. The emergency agency FEMA reached out through state emergency services to offer staff to individual hospitals earlier this week, and three in our area have accepted, and that's Community Regional Medical Center in Fresno, Adventist Health Hanford, and Cahuilla Delta Healthcare District in Visalia. Each one of those will be getting a team of 20 people, which will include critical care doctors and nurses, respiratory specialists, and others. Here's Cahuilla Delta CEO Gary Herbst on the move.
They're all highly trained and experienced and working in critical care areas. And so they will be arriving as a reinforcement team. They'll be deployed to our 21-bed medical ICU, and we will give them a patient assignment where, you know, it might be 6, 7, 8 beds or patients that they will take care of then.
And Herb said that these deployments were officially considered missions for these service members.
That's so interesting. How long is this deployment for?
Well, the contracts were signed for 30 days, but there is likely the possibility to renew beyond that.
Okay. So that will increase ICU staff at some Valley hospitals. And then you also found another creative solution for capacity issues involving Valley Children's Hospital.
Yes. And part of that hospital's surge plan includes taking on pediatric patients from other local hospitals. And that's in order to free up space at those other hospitals for COVID patients, because the majority of those are adults. They can't be treated in pediatric wards. And so far, Valley Children's has been working with other local hospitals, but they could accept patients from elsewhere in the state. And that could include ICU patients or kids with less severe issues. Here is Chief Physician Executive David Christensen.
It can be any patient they would like to send us. We are available. And then depending on the need, should the pandemic get worse and more is needed from us, we can increase our age group. You know, we normally see patients up to 18 to 21, but we would increase our age group to, let's say, 30 to help offload some of those hospitals as well. But if worse came to worse and the pandemic continued and all the hospitals were full, we would do what we need to do. And we would accept adult patients at that point.
We've been hearing that hospitals across the area are becoming inundated with patients. Does this mean that Valley Children's has been faring better than its neighbors?
Relatively, yes. Christensen says that they've definitely seen pediatric COVID cases, not enough to threaten the hospital's capacity, but the numbers are increasing as the rest of the state surges. You know, because we know that COVID is typically less severe in kids, and many are even asymptomatic, but there are still serious cases, and some are serious enough to land kids in the ICU. But also another note is that, you know, some of us may have heard of a very rare, very serious inflammatory disease known as MISC. It's something that affects kids who are exposed to COVID-19. There have only been around 1,000 confirmed cases of this worldwide, but Christensen says they have seen a few cases at Valley Children's that appear to be that disease.
And of course, we're talking about options for schools this week. Does David Christensen have anything to add to that debate?
Actually, yes. You know, he knows that he can't make recommendations in the capacity of a county or state health agency, but he says that the risks of kids picking up the disease and then carrying it either to their teachers or elderly relatives are very real. Here's what he has to say about that.
Our goal right now is we need to control this pandemic so that we can get back to our regular lives. And I know people are anxious to move fast, but we've seen what happens when we jumped the gun. You know, we've had a flare up because of that. And for most pediatricians, although we understand the importance of getting back into school, we think that at this time, the current environment with a pandemic flaring outside would make it just too risky to do so.
Well, this is all so helpful. Thank you, Carrie, for the update.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. And now we turn to mental health. This week, the Fresno County Department of Behavioral Health revealed that after a drop in the early days of the pandemic, more suicides occurred in June than in any month since at least 2017. To learn the scope of this crisis, FM89's Carrie Klein spoke with Amanda Nugent Devine, CEO of Kingsview Behavioral Health Systems, which provide mental health care and a suicide hotline for the San Joaquin Valley. Here's an excerpt from their conversation.
Human beings are made for relationship. We're made to connect with other people. We are not made for isolation. And when you put anyone, whether they have mental health issues or not, or whether they have substance use disorder issues or not, when you put them in a position to where they are not able to tap into the resources they are normally able to utilize to cope with stress, you start seeing an exacerbation of problems, or you start seeing sort of the emergence of depression and anxiety, even if they've never suffered from it before, because these are such unprecedented times. There's not a lot of information out there as to how you manage or navigate a pandemic, right? I mean, not as a complete country. And so that's been very difficult for people to adjust to. And so we have really seen a rise in suicidality. We've seen a rise in completed suicides in Fresno County. There were 17 in the month of June alone. And that's a huge increase. I know in the Bay Area, you have medical professionals that are appealing to the governor to reopen because of the mental health cost. And so it's a disturbing trend and a disturbing increase that we are witnessing all over the state of California, and I'm sure all over the nation. What is also happening is we're seeing an increase in alcohol sales and substance usage, but we're not seeing an increase in substance use disorder treatment. In fact, we're seeing a decrease. So again, that's another sort of very dangerous combination.
Well, let's talk about, there's a lot to unpack in there. Let's go back to suicide. So you mentioned that an increase in suicidality all around. And that, what does that term actually refer to? That's completed suicides and also attempts, I'm guessing, correct?
It is. We know from statistics, and I, you know, if you look at some of the national statistics sources or even the Institute of Suicidology, you're going to see that probably their most updated statistics are in 2018. So that's not reflective of the current COVID situation. So the statistics we have are sort of more local at the local level. And we have seen an increase in completed suicides, but there has been an increase also in suicidality, which is basically the suicidal ideation or contemplation. Someone seriously considering taking their lives and ending up in the ER to be assessed for whether they need to be 5150, which is hospitalized to keep them safe. And so there has been an increase in that.
And so you're seeing this rise in suicidality all throughout your coverage area?
Correct, yes. The suicide hotline has seen an increase in calls in June. We did not see an increase until June. And so some of our own sort of assessment of that is that people were able to adapt for a period of time to isolating, to doing what they needed to do, to changing their way of life. And when it looked like things were opening up, to only be sort of shut back down or pulled back has been extremely difficult for people. And we know that about stress. We know that our brain is really good at adapting to short bursts of stress. But with COVID-19, the chronicity of the stress has gone on. And when we shut back down, just even the announcement on Monday made a lot of people feel really deep despair that there is no end in sight. And we have seen just a really big uptick in response to that feeling that, wow, I thought we were at the end of this or we were coming through it.
That was Carrie Klein interviewing Amanda Nugent-Devine of Kingsview Behavioral Health Systems. You could find more of their interview at kvpr.org. If you need help, the Central Valley Suicide Prevention Hotline is 888-506-5991. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Radio Bilingue, a Latinx public radio station that started in Fresno in the 1970s, has grown into a network of 24 stations and more than 75 affiliates that reach more than 500,000 listeners each week. I had the opportunity to talk with its co-founder, Hugo Morales, who recently received the National Heritage Fellowship, the nation's highest honor in the folk and traditional arts.
Well, first of all, I'm an indigenous person. I'm a native. I'm a Mixteco. I belong to the Mixteco tribe from southern Mexico. It's based in Oaxaca, Puebla, and Guerrero. And my father was a musician. So I come from a line of cultural bearers. Includes my father, who was a violinist. And he is the one that organized the first band that is classified as the first Mexican band north of San Francisco. He was a farm worker in Sonoma County in a little town called Healdsburg, which at that time was a prune farm town. And so I never met my father until I was 9, because he was here in the United States undocumented. He left when I was about a year old. And he left the family, like, common story of immigrants, and so I never met my father, but he was a legend, even though he left the village, our village, at a very young age. You know, I longed to know, like, what he was about, and so on. He was my father. So when I came here to the U.S., I became a prune picker, you know, lived in a farm labor camp along with him and my older brother and younger sister. And I grew up in the farm labor camp with poor white people, African-American children. and with a lot of poor Latino children. We were all very, very poor. So that was the culture I grew up in poverty in Healdsburg, California, which is now considered part of the Bay Area. And so, and what was among the experiences that I had was how my father had organized other musicians to play traditional music. And so his band was the one that was the most prominent band in North Bay. And all the members of his band were indigenous. Half the band was Mixteco and the others was Otomi. And so, and all these were farm workers. And so that's how, to me, I learned about culture, music, and what music can be used. And he used music to help people, to people help themselves. We were farm workers, so he and his friends would volunteer to put dances together. And the profit from those would go towards scholarships for farm worker children and also for a fund for burial. So that's how I learned about, you know, helping others. In fact, in our indigenous tradition, we have a term for that, which is called tequio, which is giving of yourself to benefit others. And so that's the culture I grew up with. And then we use music as a way to bring people together. So to me, when we began Radio Bilingüe, and I came to Fresno in 76, I began teaching at Fresno State as a lecturer in Arasa Studies. And one of the first things I did was to put a flyer throughout the city of Fresno and ask whoever was interested in building a Latino community radio station, bilingual, to give me a call. And everybody that showed up and called me, showed up to the meeting, became a board member. That's how selective I was. And from the beginning, everybody that showed up was into the same thing. I thought I was the only one with that dream, but actually it'd been in Fresno and in other communities for a long time. And so as we began Radio Bilingüe, the traditional music was very much part of our core. And so was news and information. And at that time too, you know, this is again 1976, the beginnings and very much part of the civil rights movement for Latinos. It was a way to affirm who we were. We felt we had not been allowed to affirm that by the mainstream. And that includes by commercial Spanish language television and radio. And we wanted to do that ourselves because we're community-based. And that's, so then traditional music became very much part of us because we all listen to mariachi music. We all listen to norteño and tejano music among other genres. And so that's what we wanted to celebrate.
To what extent do you think your success and the size of your audiences have informed the mainstream media and perhaps created more space for diversity in those, you know, quote unquote, traditional organizations?
So what we've been focused on has been serving our community in the language that they understand. And so that particular thrust and those particular efforts, you know, are very important. When we now are our own, you know, network, we have 24 FM radio stations in the Southwest, 24/7 with mariachi. And it, you know, it has had an impact. I mean, I think it began a few presidential cycles ago where candidates began to use mariachis. And we want to take a little credit for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think by our own people appreciating who they are and who we are and having our own children have an appreciation for their traditions, I think that's important. And it begins with our audience. Our audience has to appreciate positively their cultural practices. In other words, they don't have to be hiding that they're listening to mariachi in their car or their home. You know, they don't turn it off when they have somebody from another culture show up. It's okay to not turn off the radio and listen to mariachi in Spanish.
Absolutely. Yeah, roll the windows down.
You know, it's okay, you know. Yeah. So And that's exactly one of the comments we got when we first went on the air in Fresno. I remember sometime during the first year, I got a call personally from a mother in Sanger who said, you know, I put you on the radio every morning and I take my kids to school in Sanger. And my children, elementary school children, are so happy because then they say, Mama, we can hear mariachi on the radio. I mean, that's a big deal. So, you know, is that kind of reinforcement, so that kind of recognition of our traditions is so important, and our children, and you know, and I think once that is recognized by our own community, and that helps in passing on the tradition, feeling also good about themselves and the positive identity of who they are, who we are, and that's important because what we want, for example, is our children to be able to succeed in school. And they cannot do that if they don't have a positive image of who they are as individuals and collectively. So music is part of that. It's in there a variety of genres in the Latino traditions, and we celebrate as many as we can.
So there is a moment of reckoning happening right now related to race in the media. And many people of color who work as reporters or work in, you know, media outlets like magazines or television or radio, you name it, film, are speaking out about their experiences of racism or microaggressions that they've had to deal with. What are your thoughts about this moment, and how do you think the media in general can do a better job to increase diversity and combat discrimination?
Well, first of all, a lot of it begins with a conversation. And so Radio Bilingue has always had race as one of the topics. You know, we have a national talk show. And we began doing, I think it's about 3 years ago, a whole series on race. And that has been a rich conversation, because racism exists also within the Latino community. And so that conversation is important to have, and being live interactive, I think, is important. And then also, you know, Latinos also experience racism as well. So that has also been part of that. And then, of course, one of the things that that impacts or that is result or negative impact of racism is the criminal justice system. So Radio Bilingue has been a platform for that conversation. And so we've had some of the most prominent advocates for that on our air. And that's really, really important for us. So we've been keeping our audiences, you know, aware about the racism and the conversation, and also the experiences, and we have done it literally from the beginning. I mean, you know, ICE has been, it's a constant, which is essentially immigration, and immigration enforcement has always been part of the conversation in our live interactive talk shows and news and information. And so I think with us, it begins with the conversation. So we at Radio Bilingue see it as our duty to have that conversation.
Well, Hugo Morales, thank you for taking the time to be with us today.
Well, thank you.
Bakersfield's South High has had a Confederate rebel for its mascot since 1957. Principal Connie Grumling told us she's now forming a committee of students, staff, and alumni to consider replacing it. The rebel's look has changed slightly since the 1980s, back when school spirit was steeped in Confederate imagery, including Jody and Johnny rebel yell leaders. And we wondered, what was that like for Black students? For this audio postcard, FM89's news director Alice Daniel reached out to Marcus Hicks, who graduated in 1986 and is now a fashion designer in New York.
You know, Jody and Johnny Rebel, who were the mascots, would come out, and, you know, Johnny Rebel's was the Confederate soldier, and Jody Rebel was like the Scarlett O'Hara type. You know, so the person who came out during the games my senior year was a Black woman Black young woman in the garb, and Johnny Rebel was Mexican. So it was super weird.
and to have school spirit with this display of racism. And it was always a disconnect for me. I always felt disconnected. Students at the time, black students particularly, didn't necessarily overtly see it or feel it as we probably do as adults, because it was so normalized. Like, it was like, oh, this is normal. This is not that big of a deal. But I think it also went with, like, we weren't actually taught anything like substantial about the histrionics of it. Like, it wasn't put in any context. I feel like the educational system itself codified that it was okay in the way that we weren't taught the history from a real perspective. Because had we had classes or teachers or books that really dealt with the subjects, it would have probably made things more difficult. I left Bakersfield and I went to San Francisco State University, and I studied Black Studies. And that was, you know, that was a part of my life where you look back at, you know, growing up and different things that happened while you grew up, and then putting it in a historical context, it was like really kind of blew up in my head. Like, this was I didn't notice it as much when it was happening until afterwards, thinking about it, looking at yearbooks and photos, and then kind of coming to grips with that discomfort, and also realizing that there was something inherently wrong with kind of being forced into a situation that wasn't good for me as a person, for my development. I just was looking on social media, and there was so much pushback to any changes to it, especially, like, I hadn't realized that they had changed the mascot to where, I don't know the name of the cap, the scrunched down Confederate cap, but they changed it to like a baseball cap. So it's the exact same thing. He's called a rebel. The colors are the same, but they changed that cap to a baseball cap. The face is the same. It's all the same as I remembered. But there was this slight adjustment. And I feel like, I don't think anyone's coming to terms with the reality of how bad it is, or that it could cause so much discomfort or pain to, like, young men and women going to school. Why not think of a mascot that looks to the future and that gives some hope instead of holding on to this awful, awful piece of history?
Again, that was Marcus Hicks, a 1986 graduate of South High. The music you heard was The Killing Moon by Echo and the Bunnymen. And that's today's Valley Edition. You could hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. And we'd love to hear from you, especially your experiences around the pandemic. Send us a voice memo on our app. Just hit the audience feedback icon and record. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Laura Satsui, Carrie Klein, and Madi Bolaños. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, acknowledging the vital work of local public health departments to keep Californians safe during the pandemic. On the web at chcf.org.